إن الحمد لله نحمد ونستعين ونستغفره ونعوذ بالله من شرور أنفسنا ومن سيئات أعمالنا، من يهدي الله فلا مضل له ومن يضلل فلا هادي له، أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له وأشهد أن محمدا عبده ورسوله. Verily our praise is due to Allah, and as such we should praise Him and seek His help and His forgiveness and seek refuge in Allah from the evil which is within ourselves and the evil which results from our action. For whomsoever Allah has guided, none can misguide, and whomsoever Allah has allowed to go astray, none can guide. And I bear witness that there is no God worthy of worship but Allah, and that Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam is the last messenger of Allah. This evening's presentation is, as brother introduced, a continuation from yesterday's talk on developing a Muslim community, the need for developing a Muslim community. And I will focus this evening on the aspect of Islamic educational institutions, which we mentioned yesterday was part of the components of developing the Islamic community, a vital part. So to try to give a better overview to the brothers and sisters in the community as to what constitutes an Islamic educational institution, what are the goals of that institution, etc., and furthermore, why it is essential for us to develop such institutions. Now, before looking at what constitutes an education institution, it's important for us to understand what constitutes Islamic education. Now, education in and of itself is regarded, as a method by which the human being is developed into a balanced personality capable of coping with his or her environment. Now, Islamic education includes both the religious as well as the academic, religious as well as what may be called secular, because fundamentally the seeking of knowledge which Prophet ﷺ insisted on was not restricted to Islamic knowledge. When he said talabul ilmi farida ala kulli muslim, seeking knowledge is compulsory for every Muslim, he didn't restrict that knowledge. However, we do understand that when looking at knowledge, we have to put things according to priority, and the knowledge which will benefit us in this life as well as the next has to be given priority over the knowledge which focuses on this life, whose value ends at the end of this life. So the religious knowledge, the knowledge of Allah and man's responsibility to Allah, to the community, etc., this has to be given precedence, obviously, over the knowledge which aids that human being in functioning in this material world. Precedence doesn't mean neglecting one or the other. The fundamental principle when looking at Islamic education is that all true knowledge is fundamentally from Allah. All knowledge which is true has come from Allah. When we look into the various sciences, etc., and you see the various discoveries that have been made, you find that oftentimes those who are seeking particular answers or particular solutions didn't find them. Instead, whilst they were looking for one thing, they happened to see something else. And then they focused on this thing and a new body of knowledge evolved. So many of the great scientific discoveries, when you go and track it down, you know, whether it is Madame Curie's discovery of, you know, radium and the whole process of X-ray, you know, photography, etc. It was accidental. Her hand happened to come between, you know, some radium, and there happened to be a photographic film hanging, and the imprint was made. She had no intention. This was not a plan at all. And the whole body of knowledge came from that. And of course, we all know of the story of Sir Isaac Newton, the apple falling on his head, and him reflecting on the laws of gravity, etc., 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 action and reaction, and all of this and that. And though we hear it as a myth, they have shown that there is a certain amount of truth to that particular incident which took place. It did actually take place. But the point is that this is science. This is much of the knowledge that we have of this world today, of what they call nature, mother nature, etc. The knowledge of the workings of this world has been through accidents. This is how they look at it, accident. What it is Allah revealing to them at certain points these bodies of knowledge. It's no accident. No accident happened in this world. What Allah has destined is what takes place. So, this is the proper view, that all true knowledge comes from Allah. Now, there is a body of false knowledge out there, which may be passed on or passed off as knowledge. You know, things like Darwin's theory of evolution, you know, and other things that are out there with these kind of claims. You know, or even, for example, Einstein's theory of relativity. Einstein's theory of relativity, as it is taught, Islamically, we look at it as false knowledge. It is a lie. E equals mc squared is a lie. Because E equals mc squared, translated literally, energy equals mass times the square of the speed of light. When this is translated into to layman's terms, they say it means that energy can neither be created nor destroyed, or that matter can neither be created nor destroyed, meaning that matter evolves or transforms into energy, and energy transforms back into matter. On the basis of this theory, they split the atom, we have the atomic bombs, we have the atomic reactors, we have all these things. But as a statement, as a scientific statement, this is a lie. It is false knowledge for Muslims. And they have to qualify it. Because if we say that energy can neither be created nor destroyed, then we are saying that there is something eternal in this world besides Allah. Uncreated means it had no beginning. Cannot be destroyed means it has no end. It is something which is eternal existence besides Allah. And we know that there is no eternal existence besides Allah. Only Allah is eternal. This is of the attributes of Allah, that He is without beginning or end. هو الأول والآخر. As the Prophet said, هو الأول وليس قبله شيء وهو الآخر وليس بعده شيء. So we cannot give this attribute to this world. So that kind of knowledge, we, although it is taught in our schools, you know, children have to learn it. We would have to teach our children to add a qualifying statement by man. Man cannot create or destroy energy. Yes, but Allah created it, and Allah will destroy it, because Allah said, "Kullu ma 'alayha fan." Everything on this world, everything in this world will be destroyed, including energy and matter. So our children have to have that kind of knowledge, that kind of realization, where false knowledge will be handed to them in the guise of true knowledge. But without those qualifications, it becomes false knowledge. The fact that they were able to split the atom with it doesn't mean that it is absolutely true. It is partially true. And on the basis of that partial knowledge, they did it. So it is very essential for us to make that distinction between true knowledge and false knowledge. True knowledge coming from Allah and false knowledge coming from man's creation. Now, that false knowledge could be either, as we expressed, formulas, explanations, like the Darwinian theory, explaining how things got where they are, or they could be false knowledge which has no basis in fact. See, we have, in the case of the Darwinian theory of evolution, there are some facts. They have bones. They've collected these bones. Now, these bones, when you put them, order them, you may interpret them one way or another way. They came to look at these bones with the belief that there is no God. So they tried to interpret these bones as justifying their belief that there is no God. That man got to the state that he is by evolution. So this is their justification for their disbelief in God. A believer can look at those same bones, analyze it, and say, this is evidence of God's creation. Because when you look at these bones, we don't see the transitional fossils that supposedly were in existence, whereby forms transform from species to species. We don't find that. So the Darwinian theory, and even Darwin, from the time that he proposed it, he mentioned that this was a problem. But he supposed that as human knowledge diggings around the world increased, that they would find the missing links. But the reality is that the more they've dug, it's the bigger the gaps. This is the reality. So much so that the leading proponents of Darwinism today, it's not even called Darwinism anymore, it's theory of evolution. Today, you know, Stephen Jay Gould, his theory, which is the most popular now, is called the punctuated equilibrium theory. Now, what is the punctuated equilibrium theory? Basically, if you put it in simple terms, it means that a dinosaur had an egg, you know, gave an egg, and from that egg came a bird. A transition from being a dinosaur, a lizard-like animal, directly to a bird. The egg, immediate transition. Nothing in between. This is what they had to propose to explain why there are these big gaps. So they just, you know, put something together, they punctuated, sounds very, very powerful, punctuated equilibrium theory, but they're saying, in effect, that, you know, a dinosaur had an egg, and from that egg popped out a bird. Meaning that, also in our case, as human beings, it means, in the end, that there was no gradual transition to human. It means that an ape-like creature gave birth to a human being. Just one time. There it started. And all of the other animals where they claim transformation from sea animal to the land animals, you know, before they were trying to say, well, you know, that these fishes, they developed, you know, these arm-like things, right? And they would flip up on the land and they would crawl on the land for a little while and then get back in the water. They had all kinds of theories about these, right? And the coelacan was one of the supposed transitional fossils. Then, in the 50s, fisherman off the coast of Madagascar pulls up in his net a coelacan. It's supposed to have died off 60 million years ago. 60 million years ago, the fossil is finished. This was a transition, and he's still swimming around, you know, off the coast of Madagascar. And since then, they've found more and more and more. They live very deep. when they bring them up, they can't bring them up alive, can't keep them alive because of the pressures, the high pressures that is down there. So they bring up their corpses all the time. They bring them up. So no more explanation by flipping on land. No, just one day a fish gave birth to a lizard, crawled out. That's it, finish. Don't try to explain how he became a lizard anymore, finish. This is the false knowledge, and in education, those being educated have to be able to realize and understand the difference between what is true knowledge and what is false knowledge. No matter how beautiful that true knowledge is put, you know, and the scientists love to, you know, to elaborate on things. One of the classical examples is the Nebraska man. From one tooth, they had pictures of a human being, complete, from head to toe, walking, the color of his skin, the hair on his body, the color of his eyes, everything, from one tooth. And after some 15 years, they found out that the tooth was that of an ancient pig, a prehistoric pig, wasn't human at all. But for some 15 years, that tooth was a whole man, a transitional form, you know, and that is science. That is a lot of science. Many times you hear people, remember some years back they were talking about cold fusion. Scientists in America claimed that they had achieved cold fusion. It was all around the world, finally cold fusion. Other people tried it here, it could work. Tried it here, it could work. Finally they said, no, it's a hoax. Margaret Mead, social anthropologist, you know, whose ideas have formed the basis for Western education. Spent all these years in Borneo, came back with her, you know, wonderful theories, observing the people of Borneo. Now, about 5 years ago, some people did research into her methodology, and only to find that she was doctoring her results. She came there with already set ideas, and she just modified, doctored, erased whatever didn't suit her ideas. Then she brought back all her data and her arguments, but it wasn't scientific. And this is not uncommon. It's something which happens time and time again within the science, so-called scientific community. So we have to educate those who go into the process to be able to make this distinction. So to recognize when false knowledge is being offered and when true knowledge is being offered. And we also have to be able to make a distinction between useful knowledge and useless knowledge. Useful knowledge and useless knowledge. Because we don't follow and subscribe to the concept of knowledge for the sake of knowledge. This is what the West likes to promote. Knowledge for the sake of knowledge. You study and just go into things just for the sake of the knowledge itself. No. From an Islamic perspective, knowledge should be for the use that can come out of it. We research, we go into areas where we can take benefits with the intention of applying that knowledge in society to improve the quality of human life. We don't spend, you know, millions of dollars trying to create life. This is the useless knowledge. The useless knowledge now. Those who would spend so much money trying to create life, or those who would spend so much knowledge trying, as they say, to turn off the biological clock so people won't die anymore, to find the cure for death. This is all useless knowledge. Why? Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has stated in the Quran that if the mankind got together, they couldn't even create the wing of a fly. They couldn't create the wing of a fly, much less create life. This is the reality. They will never. Also, it is stated by Prophet ﷺ that Allah has created a cure for every sickness. He has created a cure for every sickness. But not death. There's no cure.
No matter how much man studies and learns about the cells, etc.,
he will not find the cure for death.
That is useless knowledge.
Like man probing in the universe, trying to get to find life on some other planet, you know, in distant galaxies. Again, useless knowledge. So the process of education recognizes fundamentally, we said, that all true knowledge is from Allah. However, we should be able to distinguish between what is true knowledge and what is false knowledge. Knowledge should not be for the sake of knowledge, but it should be for its application, how human beings can benefit from it. So time and energy and money should not be spent researching, trying to develop areas which are not useful to human beings, which human beings cannot achieve, which are beyond their abilities. And related to that is a particular tradition reported by Ibn Umar and collected by Tirmidhi and the Nasa'i, in which he quoted Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam as saying, Allahumma inni a'udhu bika min qalbin la yakhsha. O Allah, I seek refuge in you from a heart which has no fear of you. A curse. When the heart has no fear of God, no fear for doing evil in their heart, they don't feel bad about it, this is the worst state that a human being can be in. Min du'a'in la yusma', from prayers which are not heard. And Allah does not accept our prayers, which will be due to certain actions that we have done in our own lives. From a nafsin la tishba, and from a soul that cannot be satisfied. No matter what we have, our desire is for more. As Prophet ﷺ said, that if the son of Adam was given a valley of gold, he would want another one. The grass is always greener on the other side. We ask Allah to protect us from our soul that is like that. Never satisfied. Means this life will be wretched if there is no satisfaction. وَمِنْ عِلْمٍ لَا يَنْفَى, and from knowledge which is of no benefit. From useless knowledge. Prophet ﷺ used to seek refuge from useless knowledge. Now, the product of Islamic education is to produce an individual who is aware of the will of God in all circumstances of his or her life, who knows their rights and is prepared to fulfill their obligations to God, to themselves, and to the society around them. This is the goal. This is the balanced individual. One who knows what Allah wants from him or her in all of the various circumstances of their life. Consequently, the Muslim students, the student that the Islamic institution is trying to produce, is one who is primarily pious, is conscious of God, which leads them to the other higher qualities of honesty, truthfulness, etc., etc. So they are not known for cheating, doing their homework from other people, not doing their homework, making excuses to their teachers and these type of things we did when we grew up. in school. These are not the qualities of a Muslim student, but one who is honest and truthful, trustworthy. Furthermore, one who is an excellent student. Why? Because Prophet Muhammad ﷺ said, "Inna Allah yuhibbu min ahadikum idha amila amalan an yutqina." That Allah loves from each and every one of you, if you do a deed, that you do it to the best of your ability. So they are educated with that sense of excellence, striving for excellence. Furthermore, they will graduate with a sense of duty and mission, that they would realize that their education was a gift, an opportunity which was given to them, that their intelligence to be able to utilize that educational opportunity was also another gift given to them by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and that they should give thanks to Allah. They should give thanks to God, not just by saying Alhamdulillah, but by service to the community. And this is how thanks to Allah is expressed. Because it's easy to say Alhamdulillah, but what one has been given, one still feels is their own to do with as and how they wish. It's my wealth, it's my knowledge, my ability, and I can use it however I feel. But that's not the case. These are all gifts from Allah, and we have a responsibility to use them in a way which is pleasing to Allah. We take benefit from it for ourselves, but we also have an obligation to the community. The community whose sacrifice and effort put us in that position. So the students should graduate with that sense of mission and responsibility back to the community. Now, when we set up in our institution our curriculum, we have a choice as Muslims between going with an English medium system or an Arabic medium system. The Arabic medium is the traditional medium which is used for the madrasas. However, when we consider that the children who graduate have to survive in this society, then we realize that we cannot make Arabic the primary medium of instruction, but that Arabic should be a part and parcel of the curriculum. That our children should graduate bilingual. Bilingual. The main instruction is in English, but Arabic is enough in the curriculum that they graduate bilingual. Because Arabic is the common language of Muslims. It is the language of the final revelation. It doesn't mean that Arabs are superior to non-Arabs, because Prophet Muhammad said in the final khutbah, what they call khutbah al-wida, Prophet which he gave to the masses of the believers on Hajj, after which he died shortly thereafter, he made it clear there that there is no superiority of an Arab over a non-Arab. Of a black over a white, or any over any other, except by taqwa, by piety. This is where superiority lies. He is reaffirming what Allah has already said in the Quran, in Surah Al-Hujurat, the 49th chapter, when Allah said, "Inna akramakum indallahi atqakum." The most noble of you in the sight of Allah are the ones who have taqwa, or the most consciousness of Allah.
So that should be part of the goal of the curriculum, that Arabic be taught in such a way that the graduates graduate bilingual. The school may be either a weekend type school or a full-time school. Practically speaking, the weekend school, as it has been demonstrated in places like North America, etc., is a failure. The weekend school cannot compete with the full-time school. So if children are in a full-time situation, non-Islamic school, and we only try to give them something on the weekend, they cannot. In some countries, they have tried to develop an afternoon school. So they go to public school in the morning, and in the evenings, they will go for a few hours, you know, they will have Islamic instruction. Again, that's better than the weekend school, but it still cannot compete, you know, 9 hours of public school and 2 hours of Islamic instruction daily. We're putting our children in a situation, you know, where they're bound to lose. And this is what has resulted in North American situation, in Canada, in England, places where they've experimented in these ways. And ultimately, people came up to the conclusion that the only solution is a full-time Islamic school. One which will only be successful if it has, again, that philosophy about which I spoke, the philosophy of Islamic education, which is not purely a religious school which is going to produce priests, ministers, you know, Muslim priests and ministers, but an educational institution which provides both academic and religious knowledge side by side. Not only side by side, but fully integrated. Meaning that even the academic knowledge has to be taught from an Islamic perspective. This is how we weed out the false knowledge and we infuse into that other body of true knowledge a consciousness in the mind of the child of the relationship between that knowledge and God. But it came from God. And that it is the right of a Muslim. We can show them partially through examples from history of the contributions of Muslim scientists in Spain and in Baghdad and elsewhere, Morocco, other parts of the Muslim world, where they contributed to what is now modern science. Okay. And we can also show them, for example, in mathematics, where there is mathematics in the Quran. All of your prime numbers, you can find examples in the Quran. It can be taken out as you're teaching the children, teaching young people, the numbering system and how it is applied. You can take examples from the Quran and from the Sunnah, you know. In the system of inheritance. This is mathematics. Fractions are involved and everything is there. So as they're being taught the academic aspects of the mathematics, they're also being exposed to the relationship within the Islamic system. So it is in the mind of the student fully integrated. Because you don't want a system where Islamic education is separate and secular education, it's called secular academic education, is separate. So the child comes out with, you know, a sense of sort of, we could call it a schizophrenic kind of approach, you know, a mind split. There is a religious side and there is a secular side. This is what has happened in the secularization of knowledge in the West, that they have removed religion and morality from the educational system. It's secularization, making it worldly. So the church separated from the state, agreement made many, many centuries ago. From the Islamic perspective, there is no separation. It is all fully
integrated. So the child should come out with that sense of full integration of the knowledge that they have, its relationship to Allah, their duty to apply it, etc., etc. Now, in terms of the staff of such a school, the staff should be primarily Muslim. We need Muslim teachers. Again, we don't need teachers who happen to be Muslims. The distinction between the two, it may sound like semantics, but in fact there is a big difference between the two. A teacher who happens to be a Muslim is one who will teach in the same way that a non-Muslim teacher will teach, whether it's Buddhist or it's Hindu or it's Christian or whatever, teaching the same. It would make no difference. Whereas a Muslim teacher, who's Muslim first, a Muslim who happens to be a teacher, that Muslim will now convey that knowledge with that Islamic perspective, distinguishing for the student between false knowledge and true knowledge. Knowledge which is useful and knowledge which is useless. Letting the child realize, the young person realize that this knowledge is ultimately from Allah, and that they have a mission in life and a duty to utilize it for the benefit of the community, for themselves and the community. That is the difference. So, the core of the staff should be Muslims who happen to be teachers, Muslim teachers. And there may be along with them some non-Muslims on the staff. It's not absolutely necessary that the whole staff be Muslim. If we can make the whole staff Muslim, alhamdulillah, fine. But if there are some gaps, and non-Muslims may fulfill this gap, there's no harm in bringing them in as long as they do not contradict the standards of the school. You see? Because again, we're setting up an Islamic institution, we're not ghettoizing Islam, because this is another idea that people have in their mind, that you know, when you set up a community, which we talked about yesterday, the idea of that community where Muslims are congregating in a particular area physically and their institutions are right in their midst, etc., that this is sort of ghettoizing Islam, you know, like Chinatown, you know, Little Italy, you know, you have in different cities, you know, but it's a different outlook. Chinatown is closed. If you're not Chinese, you cannot come inside it. You know, you cannot be a part of this. You can come live there, everything, but it doesn't matter. You're not Chinese. Same thing with Little Italy. You know, you're not Italian, forget it. You cannot make the connections. But Islamic community is one based on faith, which is not restrictive in its outlook. It feels a sense of mission and responsibility to convey that word to the outer community. It's not hiding and doing secret things amongst themselves, you know, and that's what happens in these kind of societies. When you look at Chinatown, you look at Little Italy, there are the dens of crime. Huh? The Chinese and Italian mafias. This is where their headquarters are. So they get together and they plot and they plan how they can exploit the society and drugs and control and steal, and it's what they're planning to do. Whereas from the Islamic perspective, no. The Muslim community is wide open. That's why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Quran, لا خير في كثير من نجواهم. There's no good in most of their secret gatherings. Secrecy, the secret, you know, the Masons and all these type of things, Islam opposes it because it fundamentally is evil. It's evil to the society as a whole. Of course, the Masons will say, no, we're about good things. Yes, yeah, good things for themselves. Good things for themselves. When you learn the Masonic sign, so you come into the courtroom, you've got a case to be tried, you give the judge the sign, he knows the sign, it means now he will rule in your favor. He will take the rights of other human beings and give them to you. Yes, good for you, but it is harmful to the mass of the society. So Masons, you know, this type of, you know, as we said, Chinatown, Little Italy, this kind of ghettoization of society, this is opposed in Islam. No, the Islamic community is an open community. It has no secrets, nothing to hide. It has a duty to convey that knowledge to the outer community. So in the Islamic institution, you can have teachers who are non-Muslim, but they must conform to the standards of that institution. I mean, they're not free. If you have a female teacher to come and stop, she's going to want to wear hot pants and a mini skirt, and you know, no, there's codes of dress. We have codes of dress. People are not free to dress as they wish. Yeah. We have to maintain our morality, the morality of the Islamic institution, so the non-Muslim may be invited, you know, with, because they have certain skills, and they have to conform with the standards. Similarly, you know, the administrative body, the staff, as well as administration, same thing can happen. Of course, your top administrator should be a Muslim. I mean, you cannot, logically speaking, run an Islamic institution with a non-Muslim at your head. I mean, this is nonsensical. But you will find, unfortunately, in different parts of the Muslim world, in America, they have, for example, in Chicago, they have a Muslim girls' school, and the principal is a nun. You know, it's nonsense. It's a nun, you know. So she is going to be, I mean, sure, she may be, you know, moderate, she's not openly whatever, but she's going to affect the running of the school. She cannot serve the purpose of Islam. So, you know, we may bring non-Muslims on staff in certain capacities, but it should not be in the decision-making capacities, you know, in such numbers that they will affect the whole, you know, environment of the school. Can't be. Now, the other aspect is in terms of the student body. Student body, we have a choice between a mixed student body and separation of boys and girls. In the Islamic perspective, you know, from the time the kids reach 7 and over, you know, heading towards 10, then separation should take place in education institutions. However, in circumstances where the economics, in the initial stages of development, the economics may not put the community in a position to afford a whole separate staff for the girls and a whole separate staff for the boys. So then the option would be that there is separation within the classroom. You know, that certain guidelines be maintained, you know, in terms of the classroom and how they function around the school, etc. And I've visited schools, you know, where they have maintained a strict code of conduct which has been able to minimize the negative effects which come from mixed education. Because although the argument is for mixed education today, though it was separate education, you go back 100 years ago, all over the world it's a separate education. But all of a sudden today it's all mixed. And they have promoted this throughout the Muslim world. From the colonial period, they introduced these mixed schools, mixed mediums of education within the Muslim communities, you know, to break down that concept, that sense of separation. They even tried to do studies, etc., to show how in mixed student circumstances the students perform better than in, you know, separate. But now they know that these things were falsified. The truth of the matter is that boys study better when they're with other boys, and girls study better when they're with girls. So that's why you find places in New York, so and so, they're setting up all girls schools. There's arguments about it now with the students, with the educational administrations and so. Why? How can we do this? Is this discrimination against the boys and all? Okay. Educators, this is specifically in New York, black educators, they've set up all girls schools, all boys schools. They're in the process of doing. Because they can see. I mean, you put the girls and boys together, you know, heading for puberty. I mean, obviously we know. I mean, how much time that student is going to spend on their work. I mean, their mind is going to be involved in so many other things. That distraction that is going to be there in the classroom, no doubt is going to affect the performance of the student. So, we know that the ideal is really separate education. The next best is at least separation in the classroom until we can achieve the greater ideal. Now, in terms of the body itself, student body, we don't want a closed student body, meaning that the only people, and at the same time, it is powerful dawah. It is powerful dawah. So, no doubt, once the results start to come out, and our students on the top,
you will find a society clamoring to get their kids into high school. We'll have to hold them back. And the impact, this is where the computer, through the school, through the education system, can have a powerful impact in the society. Because they will have to question, they will have to wonder, why? Why are they succeeding? Why are they? Because of the way that the system is set up. How we have prioritized our education, our staff, the academic excellence of the staff, how the children are encouraged in their forms of academic pursuits. So, we said that the overall body of the school can include non-Muslims in the student body as well as in the teaching staff, you know, and some aspects of administration, maybe accounting or whatever, you know, depends. Minor aspects which don't have an effect in the policy of the school, either executive or legislative. The next aspect of the school that should be considered, reflected upon, is the funding of the school. Whether the school is going to be government funded. I don't know in the Bahamas whether they have some room for government funding, support of private schools. They do. Well, one has to see to what degree, what is required, you know, what are you required to comply with to achieve that funding. If to achieve that funding it means compromising basic principles of school, then of course it has to be abandoned. Then the other option, of course, is private funding. And private funding means then ultimately we have to decide whether the school will be run as a business, as a charity, or whether it will be self-financed. And the community has to determine which is the best option for itself. To be a charity would be a major burden on the community, meaning that the community would have to be paying out constantly. Every year they would have to be raising funds to keep this thing going. You know, like some of the Islamic schools in America, like that in California, run by brothers Masjid Medina School, right? Masjid al-Mu'minin. That every year they have to go on trips around the Muslim world looking for handouts to keep the school going. I mean, on one hand it is somewhat degrading. On another hand, the funds are drying up. So it is not really a viable approach. Because it's something that may work for a while, and when funds dry up, then the school will not be able to sustain itself. So it means that it either has to be a business, meaning that the setting up of the school is turned over to a corporation. In the community, some people make this a business. It's the business of education, for the sake of Allah. Not just business for the sake of the business, but business for the sake of Allah. It is legitimate that some members of the community, they invest what is going to be required to pay the staff, etc., 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 the students' fees, etc., etc., which comes back to them. A portion of it, of course, covers their expenses, and they get profit from it. This is legitimate. Perfectly legitimate. As long as the fees are reasonable, they're not putting it to the point where Muslims cannot get their children in the school, and there should be some scholarships for Muslim, you know, families who cannot afford whatever, should be there. So taking care of that aspect of the need of the community. So it could be as a business, or it could be self-financed, meaning that the monies in the school is set up, the monies to run the school is generated from the fees, which comes from the students. It goes back to the maintenance of the school and the school's expansion. I mean, there are no profits that people are collecting as individuals. And it's for the community to decide which one is the most effective for their particular circumstance. Of course, in the area of education, there are certain
a number of aspects which, you know, would have to be looked at, especially in the area of physical education. You know, there are certain skills which Prophet Muhammad recommended, like swimming. The children, the young age, you know, before they reach the age where for girls to go swimming in public, this is not possible anymore. You know, and that you, the children are taught to swim by the time they're 7 years old. Finish. Once you learn how to swim, no matter how old you get, you know how to swim. That's it, finished. It's like riding a bicycle. You did it as a kid, you can pick up one now. You're not going back to that early stage where you're wobbling and all the stuff. So they learn to swim by the time they're 7. So that becomes a skill which they put behind them. 7 to 10, you've learned how to swim. In circumstances where the issues of nakedness and the beach and all the problems don't arise. Good teachers, I mean, I knew a brother, for example, in Riyadh, Brother Hudayfa from Philadelphia. I mean, he was a swimming instructor, and he used to teach children like a 1 year old, 8 months old how to swim. Yeah. I mean, if they know the skill, a good instructor can do that. So I'm saying that way the children, the girls are given that knowledge. And it is important knowledge. What you read about incidents that happen around the world every time, every year. You know, there are how many ferries capsize and people drown. Why they drown? Because they don't know how to swim. You know, mostly women and children drowning. The plane crashes, they're flying in a plane, crashes into the ocean. People drown, don't know how to swim. So, swimming is recommended by Prophet Muhammad. So when we approach the whole issue of physical education, again, we're looking at it from the point of view of benefit. How does it benefit the individual in the society? So we won't spend time, waste time, teaching the children cricket and football, volleyball. I mean, they can play with that themselves on their own, whatever. But to teach them in the school to, as a part of an educational program, then we know that they should be taught, you know, karate, judo, you know, the skills which can, physical skills which can benefit them. You know, running for strength, etc., to build themselves up, you know, these type of track and field type skills which are useful in building their physical strength. So always, whatever field of knowledge that we go into in the school, we will always look at it from the point of view of the Quran and Sunnah first. What does Islam propose in terms of this area of education? And then we gather the knowledge that's available out there, which is useful knowledge, and we separate the useless knowledge from it. Because, for example, in karate, you know, there's a part of karate which involves bowing, you know. It's a religion. There's a religion connected to it. The religious aspect. So those aspects we take out, we remove. Because as Muslims, it's not permissible for us to bow to others. It's a religious act. We're not allowed to bow. So, in that way, whatever skills that are learned, etc., you know, we remove the aspects which are against Islam, and we take from it the core, which ultimately that knowledge, we said it's from Allah, it's real knowledge. Knowledge of self-defense, so it's from Allah ultimately. You know, many of these, when you look into the histories, you know, the stories, and some of them are like myths or whatever, but they talk about, you know, how these different arts and thoughts were developed, you know, that early Buddhist monks or whatever, they were looking at the dragonfly, or they were looking at the praying mantis, so they're looking at nature and the animals and how they move and so on. From these knowledge from Allah. Where did the animals learn these things? These are things which were put in their genes by Allah. So the human being takes from them different movements, etc., etc., and applies it to his life, and it's beneficial. So we take that aspect of it which is useful, the other aspect which they connected up with Buddhism and these other, you know, isms, and we leave that aside. And of course, you know, as we said in the very beginning, that our institution is best placed in the midst of our community. That the school should not be off somewhere, but it should be in the middle of the community. So ultimately the success of this school is going to depend on the internal hijra about which we spoke yesterday. The need for the internal hijra, where Muslims will congregate, bring themselves in a particular area, as has been designated here, the area which the Masjid and School Foundation is now presently existing, has this become a focal point for the Muslim community. That the institutions created within that community will have the full support of the community. And that way it is assured. And oftentimes, for young people, children, and for women, they need that social contact with other Muslims on a regular basis, on a daily basis. This helps to strengthen them, helps them to feel confident about their Islam. But when they only meet, as we talked about before, on Fridays, talks, they come together occasionally, but the rest of the time they spend mostly around non-Muslims, etc., you'll find that, Muslims, women and children, and men, making compromises, being shy about their Islam. The time for prayer comes, you're in a non-Muslim's house. I mean, how many people are ready to say, okay, please excuse me, I have to go and make my prayers now. Okay, we got a room, can I go pray in this room? Most people will delay the prayer, until you leave and go home and pray. Why are we shy? Why are we shy about our Islam? We feel ashamed in front of non-Muslims. We're not ashamed in front of Allah. We're not ashamed to disobey Allah, but we're ashamed to offend our non-Muslim hosts. Gross. This is saying something about the quality of our faith. That it is definitely sick. It is in need of health, of medicine. And that medicine is the community. The community helps that individual who has these weaknesses become strong. The community about which is described as Allah's hand is on the community. His support is there to the community. When people deviate from that community, as we spoke before, that they deviate into hell, ultimately. They become prey for the satanic forces that are out in the society. And we all know this. This is something I don't need to go back at length on. So, what I'm proposing here is the philosophy of the Muslim institution, the school that we spoke about yesterday that needs to be set up. We talked about why it needs to be set up at length yesterday. It's not really necessary to go back into that again. It is fundamentally needed in order for Islam to go from our generation to the next. Without it, we are going to lose. In the next 10, 15 years, we're going to lose seriously many of the young people of this community. So we have agreed that it is an absolute necessity for survival of our children, whom, if they don't have this opportunity, the sins of their deviation, of their apostasy, is borne by us. Because it is our responsibility as parents to provide for them proper Islamic education. It is our responsibility. And if the children deviate due to its absence, then we carry the sin. We will have to answer before Allah on the Day of Judgment for not providing that opportunity for our children. So we said that it goes without saying that this is an absolute necessity that we have to focus our energies on, along with the internal hijrah, along with establishing the masjid, etc. All of this has to come together. We can't put it way down the line. We cannot afford to. Time is running out. And every day that we maintain the status quo is another day in sin. So, brothers and sisters, let us bring our minds together and make that commitment, that spiritual commitment, to fulfill this necessary project in our community. The project which is a part and parcel of our religious duties. It is part of our ibadah that we establish this institution. Education is the right of our children, and it is our responsibility to give them the proper
education. Inshallah, we will give the rest of the evening's time to discussion. Anyone would like to further advance on this topic? If there are no particular issues that people want to discuss, or we exhaust the issues, then we can go on to some general discussion. But inshallah, let me stop here now and give you all an opportunity to give me some feedback. Let us discuss the needs here and how we can fulfill these needs.
I think the point that you raised about non-Muslim attending a person who wants to tell a statement or question to come closer to the mic, so at least what they're saying can be heard by the system as well. That's probably the point that was raised about the non-Muslims attending the Muslim school. Now, and it is quite true, because I think a very good example is seen in the way the schools of the Catholics and the Anglicans and the Methodists have been established here in the Bahamas. When the priests came here, I think it was back in the late 30s or 20s, 30s or something like that, when they first came. There weren't any Catholics on this island. But they set up schools, in addition to their little churches. You know, every church has a school. And, you know, you look at all the Catholic churches here in the island, they all have schools. And through these schools, they were able to attract people who were not Catholics. And as a result of them attending school, I myself, I was raised in the Catholic system from kindergarten all the way to college. Okay. I've seen other people, you know, people of different religious persuasions who come into that setting, and they end up being baptized as Catholics. And that has happened on all levels, okay, not just in the primary school, but also in the high school as well as in college. So I know that that would work in terms of Islamic dawah, getting other non-Muslims to come into Islam. And I think that brothers and sisters have to understand that, you know, in doing this, you know, there is going to be a lot of sacrifice involved. The Catholics were able to do it because, for one thing, I think that many of them were supported by their diocese in their mother or whatever the community they came from. Okay. For example, the priests that came here in the Bahamas were of what they call the Benedictine Order, and they had their headquarters in Minnesota. You know, they were supported by that institution, and they were able to do a lot of things from their support. But they also set up while they developing their schools, they charge fees. Eventually, most schools that you go to, you have to pay fees. Both private schools, parochial schools, they have to pay fees in order to attend these schools. Right? Every year the fees are going up. I think for a child to attend Queen's College, which is the Methodist school, or St. John's, which is the Anglican school, or SAC, Catholic school, you know, they have to come with some big bucks. But these schools have always maintained good reputations too, okay, because of the fact that they have that religious bent to it, you know, because they're, they emphasize a lot of physical activity. You know, sports was not an option, it was a requirement. I mean, you had to participate in some physical activity, whether it was track and field or baseball or softball, all those kind of different things. You had to participate. And I think that it sounds very good for us that we would want to make sure that our children participate in those physical activities that would be beneficial for their development, physical development to help them to survive better in society, to defend themselves and so forth. And this really sounds very, very good, but I do know, and I want to keep emphasizing to the brothers and sisters here, that we must be prepared to make the necessary sacrifice to see this become a reality. And I won't say any more on that. Just want us to understand that this is something we must do, and we must be prepared to make sacrifices to do it, inshallah.
I have a question. Myself and a few other brothers in the community as kids that are out there in those schools, and we do not have total control of our children as far as their education are concerned. Myself, for instance, my kid's mother is not Muslim, and I'm going through a fight. I wasn't here last night, but as you close the lecture tonight, you mentioned the sin of the parents as far as the education of the children. I'd like you to explain the position of myself and some of the other brothers, the direction in which I should take, or whatever. You know, my kids being in these private schools, and their mother's not a Muslim, and I'm a Muslim. I don't want them there. But, you know, what can I do? And in this community, it is tough. And what can I do?
With regards to children who are in the system right now, where a Muslim, his children are being raised by a non-Muslim. I mean, this is a particular circumstance. And then the other circumstance is children within the public school system right now, where there is no other alternative, there's no Islamic school, right? So the only option besides that is to take the children home and to educate them at home, okay? So that's one question, how do we do, what is the best approach in this matter? And the other question, which is your particular circumstance, where your children are being raised by a non-Muslim. And of course, this is fundamentally against Islamic teaching. If the children have been given by the state to your non-Muslim wife, this is something beyond your control. You know, this is where you know, some people, some brothers in other parts in the United States, etc., you know, have taken another option, that of taking their kids and making hijrah out of the West. You know, this is report me to the police here that I'm advocating kidnapping and, you know, etc. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, it is an option which a Muslim who finds himself in such a situation would have to consider seriously, because these are his children. According to Islamic law, his children should be raised as Muslims. And if this woman, for example, you know, is a non-Muslim, and she is definitely against the raising of the children as Muslims, you know, or she will be at some point in time, chances are great, you know, then one has to consider, for the sake of the children, some other option. So that's the bottom line. You know, what I'm saying, this is a real option which Muslims have to consider. You know. Now, in terms of the educational system, we have, you know, put in the children in the existing educational system or trying to teach them at home. Now these are two options that are in front of people. We know that the educational system is bombarding them with so many negativities, you know, it's distorting their nature. All this is going on. At the same time, bringing the children home when you and your wife are not capable, either you don't have the academic skills or the background or the time because of the work that you're doing to provide the children with a decent academic education along with the religious education. So the religious education you should be giving them anyway by your example in the home, you know, by maintaining an Islamic environment there anyway, whether they're going to the non-Muslim school or whether they're staying at home. So that, you know, the religious education aspect is got to be there in both cases anyway. But when you bring the children home, now what you have to consider is the academic. Are you going to be able to provide them with the academics? It can be done depending on the age of the children. Very early age when education is basic reading, writing, arithmetic. You know, you can get the books. In the United States, there are whole systems that have been set up for home education. You contact these people, they got all kinds of literature and material, you know, prepared with testing and everything. There's a number of people in America who are actually educating their children at home. So it's a route that one can take, but one should not take it with a lackadaisical kind of attitude. I'll just keep my kids at home. They don't need to know how to read and write. It's enough for them to learn Quran. This is maybe enough for you as an individual, yourself, but it is not fair to deprive the children of a decent and acceptable level of academic education so that they will be able to make choices later in their life. Because you deprive them of that, you deprive them of the right to make certain choices in terms of their higher education. So if we're going to do it, let's do it properly. It means get the proper systems. You're going to have to commit yourself, sacrifice your own time, your wife's time. You know, and the best way to do it again is if the community has moved to an area, like the area there, before the school gets set up, that when you have three or four other families or five other families doing the same, then it's a lot easier because the teaching education can be shared. Some can specialize in some areas, some can specialize in other areas among the women and so on and so forth. And the younger children, you know, this can be much more effectively done. Homeschooling can be more effectively done when there are others cooperating, you know, with us. Right? In terms of putting the children in the school, of course, one has to keep those who take that option, one has to keep, you know, a constant monitoring system on the children. Keep a regular check. Because there is a certain point when their personality starts to change. I mean, if it is that, alhamdulillah, you're able to give them a good solid foundation, you know, maybe they're in the school with three or four other Muslim kids, so they do have a group that they can relate to, so they don't have to be absorbed into the non-Muslim, you know, a majority. You know, there are certain factors that can help them survive in those circumstances. If you see them surviving, you keep, you know, staying on top of it, giving them additional material in the home to help to try to keep them on that path, and the contact with other Muslim families, etc. But you have to keep a constant monitor because, as I said, there's a point where if, you know, these things are not effective, now that child's personality can change in a very serious way. And there are signs that show up, you know, that you have to be constantly monitoring and looking for. But once you see it, then you know that's the time when you have to pull that child out of that system and try to find some other option for them. You know, you have to figure out something else. So I think at this point in time, the two options are there. We should respect each other's choice on what option they have taken. But in both cases, it has to be done properly. I mean, we can't just throw them in the school and say, you know, it's all right, and, you know, they're okay, they're good Muslims. No, they have to be monitored, they have to be checked, they have to be fought, they have to be followed up. They should be there with other Muslim kids that they can relate to. And on the other hand, if we're going to bring them home, it's another option. They should be respected if we do that, but it should be done properly. They should get what's necessary to provide the children with the proper academic education along with Islamic education coming from the environment as a whole. A written question on the point of Muslims acquiring knowledge that is useful, beneficial. I would like to know if it is permissible for Muslims to become veterinarians or environmental scientists, since they deal with animals and the environment around us. Veterinarian knowledge is useful if we have a need in this particular community. If this is not a cattle-raising community, we don't have sheep and goats and cows and things like this, then to become a veterinarian here is a useless piece of knowledge for this community. When the community does reach the point of raising, if you buy land, suppose they decide to raise sheep and raise their own goats and stuff like this, which is something which we can conceive in the future, at that point in time, then we do need that kind of knowledge. But for now, when we're putting our children into higher education, then it is better to focus in the areas that are primary for the development of the community. Primary, you know, absolute needs, where there's major gap, where we need people right now to fill these gaps. So this is what I would advise. You know, same thing with the environmental sciences. Well, this is like, you know, a secondary level. It's good knowledge, but to the need of the community right now, we don't need environmental sciences. I mean, if you become that, then you will work in the government. You'll serve the needs of the government and the general society, but the Muslim community, very little of that knowledge can you use to benefit the community directly. So I would say that, you know, we should try to channel our children into fields which are more relevant to the needs, the immediate needs of the community. Because rather we're going to fulfill those needs to a large degree from within our own community, or we'll have to import people. Invite people, and of course this is not bad, to invite other Muslims from other parts of the Muslim world, whether it's in, you know, North America or, you know, other parts of the Muslim world, in Africa and Asia, etc., to come and help us in the building of the community. This is good for people also to see, you know, a multicultural aspect of Islam. You know, it's very important, because truly Islam is not a black thing. It's not the Afro-Bahamian thing. I mean, Islam is Islam. It goes beyond these barriers, right? And it's very good if the community can exhibit that to the population at large. So it is a good idea, even in the process of setting up our institutions, etc., and we do invite some, you know, people from the Muslim, academics, etc., from other parts of the Muslim world to make it see that multicultural aspect of Islam. When girls reach puberty, can they still go to the beaches, even though they are dressed properly and among their family and other Muslim sisters? Yes, if they're not going swimming. You know, if they're not going swimming. But, in general, going to the beach here, I mean, means being bombarded with much nakedness. And unless you find some beaches where these people don't congregate, you know, if you can find those beaches, then it's perfectly okay. You know, or go early in the morning, or whatever, you find the time. But, you know, that's why you're supposed to qualify that. I mean, I don't want to say that it's just okay if you go to the beach any time, because, I mean, we have to also take into account that that haram aspects of the beaches today. How can I teach art in the best Islamic approach? You know, art, we can focus with young people, we can focus on nature, on art which leads, for example, ultimately to architecture. because again, art for just decoration's sake, you know, art for art's sake, it is not something admirable in Islam. Though we have, you know, examples of, you know, Alhambra Palace in Spain, when they show the signs of Islamic, you know, architecture, all these fancy, but when you actually analyze it, you know, the problems are set up since the worst money you can spend is on the decoration of buildings, you know, decoration of the masjids. This is not light in Islam, because it's a waste of time and energy. Instead of using those skills to build things which are useful to people, and of course it doesn't have to be so utilitarian that it's just four walls. I mean, you can still, in the style of your architecture, encompass, you know, some aspect of beauty in it. I mean, Islam is, as the Prophet said, Allah is beautiful, they love beauty. You know, so beauty is there. We're not saying go from one, again, we don't go from one extreme to the other. Right? Alhambra is in one extreme, you know, and going to a total utilitarian, just four walls type of existence is another extreme. We don't need to go from one to the other. We find that is a path. So, art can be taught, you know, through the child, for example, in drawing or buildings and the society around and nature, etc. And in teaching them this, they can learn, those of them who have an inclination towards architecture, you know, these kind of sciences which have to do with the skills, the drawing skills, you know, can be brought out, you know, which are useful in the development of this community, etc.
He was mentioning about the factor of different physical aspects like martial arts, yoga, meditation, prophetic. It's also intended on your intentions, though, because a lot of the movements that are in martial arts or yoga or meditation, it comes from other scholars. So, you know, in other words, there's part of it is like in your bowing and your stretching. Some of them are sagged, some of them, you know, are positions that we use to go, but it's also with the intentions in your heart, though, what your intentions are, right? And if you, from my understanding, if you could explain it to your class before they go through it, let them know that you're not bowing to another human being or bowing to an idol, you know, but this is a part of an exercise, because you had a lot of martial artists that were Muslims. They get up in the morning and make the prayers, and they still do it now. They get up in the morning and make the prayers, and they read the Quran, and then they go to the training, you know, which involves the vow, and, you know, involves the various things. But at the same time, they understand, they know what their intentions are. So we can explain it again.
So we have a general principle in Islam regarding intentions, that deeds are judged by their intention. This is the principle that you're trying to apply here, right? But this cannot be taken out of context. The context in which Prophet ﷺ said that was in halal deeds. He said, halal deeds. Prophet ﷺ said that whoever makes hijrah for the sake of Allah, then, and his messenger, his hijrah is for the sake of Allah and his messenger. Whoever makes hijrah for the dunya, or for a woman to get married to, then his hijrah is for what he made his hijrah for. Okay? But what is he talking about here? Prophet Muhammad is talking about hijrah, which is a halal act. Right? So, when we talk about intentions, and deeds being judged by intentions, we're talking about halal deeds, meaning, if you do something which is halal in Islam, which is prescribed in Islam, if you do it for the sake of Allah, you reward you by Allah for it. If you don't do it for the sake of Allah, then you don't gain that reward for it. You get whatever physical benefit there is involved in this world, and that's what you got. There is no reward from Allah for it. That's what I'm saying? For example, if you made salah, right, you made salah for the sake of Allah, because this is obligated, you know, Allah is obliging you to do it, and you know that it is
good for you, and you know, it will increase your consciousness of Allah, and you do this for all these purposes, then Allah rewards you for it. But if you get up to pray, as you come to the masjid, because you want to show the community that you are a Muslim, it's your intention. The thing about Allah is that Allah is not there. Your intention is just to show the Muslim community that you are a Muslim, okay? So you want to be admired, you know, as being a part of the Muslim community. And in the course of your prayer, you will take your time and pray, you know, long and slow prayers and everything. So people will say, you know, what a good Muslim brother this is, you know, he's really down with his salah, you know, down. But when he goes home, you know, his salah is like jumping jack flash, you know, it's finished in a minute. But when he's in the masjid, taking his time. So that person, he doesn't get the reward for it, because he was seeking, you know, the personal, the admiration of the community, etc. So for that halal deed, his intention will determine whether he got a reward or not. But now in the case of haram deeds, you see, we cannot talk about good intentions making haram deeds permissible. Because if we do this, then we fall into the Machiavellian principle that the ends justify the means, you see. And we don't believe that. We believe that the means will determine the ends. If you use halal means, you get halal ends. If you use haram means, you get haram ends. This is under normal circumstances. Of course, there's exceptions. Where your life is threatened, right? You crash in an airplane, you know, airplane crash, the only thing that is available a bottle of alcohol, if you don't drink some of that, well, you're going to starve to death, right? So now, this thing is haram, and it remains haram. You take from it what is enough to keep yourself alive, right? Your intention here is to stay alive. Allah tells you, don't kill yourself. So your intention is to stay alive. So in that case, Allah absolves you of the sin involved in taking that alcohol. But of course, the difference is now, if when you take that glass, you take 3 sips and you feel yourself alive. I mean, your spirit was going, you felt yourself dying, it took 3 sips to keep you alive. But now, if after you've had your 3 sips, you say, good, you know, then you finish off the glass, and that remaining amount, that was haram. Clearly, you will be held simple, you know, accountable for it. So, as I said, fundamentally, the principle of deeds, you know, it is according to halal. Now, Prophet ﷺ forbade us from taking any of the positions of prayer as a means of honoring or greeting others. Standing for prayer, Prophet ﷺ forbade for other people. When people stood up, when he came, he told them, sit down. Don't stand. Because they're standing up in honor as a prophet. People who want people to stand for them in this life will find themselves standing in the hellfire. You know, we stand for Allah. We bow for Allah. And we prostrate for Allah. It doesn't matter. People use it in India, amongst the Buddhists, etc. The children will prostrate at the feet of their parents as a means of greeting their parents. You know? Okay, this is their means of greeting. Their intention is not worship, but it is greeting. But the point is that, from Islamic perspective, here intention is not the issue. It is not permissible for a Muslim to prostrate, to bow, or to stand for anyone other than Allah. Right? And this is proven, for example, from the issue of intention, and haram thing, an incident which took place in Mecca, which is related to Prophet, wherein he was told that there was a woman in Mecca who prostituted herself, sold herself, and the earnings that she gained from it, she gave in charity. Giving in charity is a good thing. Prostitution is a horrible thing. So they asked.